All right, so get this. Imagine being told you can't voice your opinion on something like a tax law just because you work for a company.
Sounds a little crazy, right?
Totally. But that's the spark that lit the fire for this landmark First Amendment case, First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti.
A 1978 case that's still shaping how we view corporate power and free speech today.
Big time. This isn't just some dusty old legal history. This is a deep dive into a debate where the lines get blurry fast.
So buckle up, we're about to unpack a case that had major ripple effects.
Okay, so picture this, 1976, Massachusetts.
Bell bottoms, disco balls.
Exactly. But seriously, there's this heated debate brewing over a possible graduated income tax.
And corporations want in on the action. They want to voice their opinion.
But there's a catch.
Ooh, what big one?
Lay it on me.
Massachusetts had this law on the books, said corporations couldn't spend money to influence referenda unless it directly affected their business.
Okay, so that makes sense. Like, a company can spend money to oppose a law that would directly impact their industry.
Right, but here's the kicker. The law specifically carved out ANY issue around individual taxes.
Whoa, so even if these companies felt the tax would indirectly impact the overall economy, they couldn't say a word.
They were legally muzzled. And that's what set the stage for First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti.
These corporations, led by First National Bank of Boston, felt like their First Amendment rights were being straight up violated.
Yep, they cried foul and took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
So this wasn't just some local squabble. This went all the way to the top.
It did, and those justices had some seriously weighty questions to grapple with.
Like what? What were the core issues at stake here?
Well, first off, they had to figure out if corporations as entities even have free speech rights under the First Amendment.
I mean, they're not individuals, they're these legal constructs, so it gets kind of murky, right?
Super murky.
So did the court say if corporations had the same right to free speech as a person?
That was the first question. The second was, even if they do have those rights, should they extend to issues that aren't directly tied to their business, like this income tax?
So it wasn't just about taxes. It was about fundamentally redefining who gets to participate in shaping public opinion and policy.
Exactly. It raised the stakes, made people ask if giving corporations such a powerful voice really empowers citizens.
Or if it actually drowns them out.
That's the debate right there.
Okay, so let's dive into the arguments themselves. What was Massachusetts' justification for essentially silencing these corporate critics?
They had two main points. First, they argued that allowing corporations to spend freely on political campaigns would drown out the voices of individual citizens.
So their worry was that it would create an uneven playing field where corporate money could bulldoze over everyday folks trying to be heard.
Exactly, like David versus Goliath, but with wallets instead of slingshots.
Okay, that makes sense. What was their second point?
It was about protecting dissenting shareholders.
Huh. Okay, explain that one.
So imagine you own stock in a company, right? You're a shareholder,
Yeah.
and that company decides to throw a ton of money behind a cause you absolutely hate. Like it goes against everything you believe in.
Not a good feeling.
Nope. So Massachusetts argued that this law was there to prevent that kind of forced political participation.
So it was about protecting people from having their investments used to support causes they vehemently oppose.
Right. They were trying to shield individuals from feeling like they were being dragged along for a political ride they didn't sign up for.
It seems like they were trying to find a balance, right? To uphold the principle of free speech while also acknowledging the potential for corporate influence to distort things.
They were walking a tightrope for
Yeah.
sure. But what about the corporations? What was their side of the story?
Yeah, let's hear it. Why did they feel like this law was a big old First Amendment violation?
They argued that free speech is free speech, regardless of who's doing the talking, plain and simple.
So, a corporation expressing its views is no different than an individual doing the same.
Exactly. They said that trying to silence corporations actually hurts the public because it deprives them of valuable viewpoints and information.
So they were flipping the script, saying limiting corporate speech is actually harmful to a healthy democracy.
Their logic was more speech, no matter the source, leads to a more informed citizenry.
They believed in the marketplace of ideas, that people could weigh the merits of different arguments and decide for themselves.
Right. They argued that the government shouldn't be in the business of picking winners and losers in the battle of ideas.
Wow, this is already getting my head spinning. So we've got these two compelling sides to this legal tug of war.
Yep, freedom of speech versus worries about corporate influence.
What did the Supreme Court ultimately decide? Which side won out?
This is where it gets interesting. In a 5-4 decision, The court sided with the corporations.
A nail biter. So they struck down the Massachusetts law.
They did. It was a huge victory for corporate speech rights.
What was their reasoning for such a landmark decision?
Well, Justice Powell, who wrote the majority opinion, he basically said that the First Amendment doesn't discriminate.
I mean,
he argued that the value of speech, its ability to inform the public, doesn't depend on the identity of the speaker.
So a corporation trying to sway public opinion is no different than you or me voicing our opinions.
Precisely. And here's the line that really became famous. Powell wrote, quote, "The inherent worth of speech in terms of its capacity for informing the public does not depend upon the identity of its source, whether corporation, association, union, or individual," end quote.
Wow. That's powerful stuff. It basically puts corporations and individuals on equal footing when it comes to the First Amendment.
It was a bold statement.
So the court's stance was that if you're worried about harmful speech, the answer isn't censorship, but more speech.
That's the gist. They felt that more voices, even corporate ones, ultimately leads to a more informed and engaged public.
Fascinating. But the court didn't just strike down the law on philosophical grounds. They also had some issues with how the law itself was written, right?
Oh, absolutely. They actually pointed out some pretty glaring flaws in the law's construction.
Like what?
They said it was under-inclusive because it exempted media companies from the restrictions.
So news outlets could say whatever they wanted on any issue, but other corporations were muzzled.
Exactly. And they also said it was over-inclusive because it banned all non-business-related corporate speech.
So not just the political stuff, but anything that wasn't directly tied to a company's bottom line.
Yep, it was like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, way too broad in its scope.
So the court was basically like, even if we agreed with your goal, Massachusetts, this law is a mess.
Pretty much. It highlights how even when dealing with these big constitutional questions, the details of how a law is crafted, they really matter.
It's all about the fine print.
Always.
This is already giving me a lot to think about, and we haven't even gotten to the dissenting opinions.
The dissent in Bilotti. That's where things get even more interesting.
Because the dissent laid out some anxieties about corporate power that are arguably even more relevant today than they were back then.
It's true. Those dissenting voices really foreshadowed a lot of the debates we're still having about corporate influence in our society.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's hear what those dissenting justices had to say about this whole corporate speech showdown.
Let's do it. So the dissent, it's like this time capsule full of worries that still resonate today, maybe even more now.
Give me the highlights.
All right. So Justice White, he wrote a dissent and Brennan and Marshall joined him.
Okay.
White's main point, his big argument, was that corporations, they're just not like people.
Because they're creations of the state right, they exist to make a profit, not to be political players.
Precisely. He argued that giving them the same First Amendment rights as individuals, especially in the political sphere, it's a recipe for disaster.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Why? Why was he so worried about corporate speech and politics?
He was worried about power, about the potential for corporations to drown out the voices of everyday citizens.
So it's that classic fear, right? That corporate money could basically bulldoze over the will of the people.
Imagine this. It's election season. Tons of money flying around.
A political ad every 5 seconds.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then a corporation comes in, dumps millions into supporting a candidate who's, let's say, friendly to their interests.
Okay.
Meanwhile, regular people, they're struggling to even get their voices heard amidst this tsunami of corporate cash.
So it's not about free speech. It's about who has the loudest megaphone.
That was White's nightmare, that corporate spending could warp the whole democratic process.
And make it less about what the people want and more about what corporations want.
Exactly. And it wasn't just about the volume, it was also about coercion.
Coercion. Explain.
So let's say you're a shareholder in a company, right?
Gotcha. I own a tiny piece of this big corporation.
And then that company decides to, I don't know, use a bunch of its profits to support a cause you find morally wrong.
Uh-oh.
You're basically stuck, right? Your money, your investment, is being used to support something you disagree with.
That would be infuriating. To feel like your own money is being used to undermine your beliefs.
That was White's point. He was trying to protect shareholders from this kind of scenario.
So he saw this law as a shield, right? To protect individuals from being forced to go along with a corporation's political agenda.
Exactly. It was about individual rights, about making sure people's voices weren't being drowned out or hijacked.
It's a tricky balance, though, right? Freedom of speech is important, but so is making sure the system is fair.
Totally. And remember, this was back in 1978. These worries about corporate influence, they've only grown since then.
It's like Justice White was a time traveler, warning us about the future of campaign finance.
Maybe he was on to something.
Okay, so White wasn't alone in his dissent. Justice Rehnquist also had some interesting things to say.
Rehnquist's dissent, it's fascinating.
Why? What made his take unique?
He agreed with the majority's decision to strike down the Massachusetts law.
Okay, so he was on the side of corporate speech.
Sort of, but here's the thing. He was still deeply troubled by the potential for corporate wealth to mess with public discourse.
So it was like, I agree with the outcome of this specific case, but I'm really worried about where this might lead.
Exactly. He was basically saying, hold on, I'm not so sure about this whole giving corporations the same rights as people thing.
What were his specific concerns?
He was worried about money, about the potential for corporate money to muscle its way into the political arena and crowd out the voices of everyday people.
Like, what if corporations just start throwing their weight around, using their money to drown out any dissenting opinions?
That was his fear, that we'd end up with a system where the loudest voice, the one with the most money, always wins.
Regardless of whether it's right or wrong.
Right. And he worried that Bilotti, this case, it was opening the door to that kind of distorted reality.
It's like he saw the writing on the wall,
mm-hmm.
that corporations were going to become increasingly powerful players in the political game.
And that individual voices, the voices of ordinary people, would get lost in the shuffle.
That's pretty bleak.
It is. And it makes you wonder if those fears, if they've come true.
I mean, look at the state of campaign finance today.
Right. Super PACs, dark money. It's like a whole different world compared to 1978.
It feels like the anxieties that the dissenters in Bilotti had, those anxieties have become our reality.
It's true. This case, it wasn't just about a tax law in Massachusetts. It was about something much bigger.
It was about the soul of our democracy.
Exactly. And it seems like that debate, the debate about corporate power and its place in our political system, it's far from over.
Definitely not. In fact, it feels more relevant than ever.
Before we get too doom and gloom, it's important to remember that there were arguments in favor of expanding corporate speech rights.
Right. It wasn't like the majority opinion was totally unfounded.
The justices who sided with the corporations, they had their reasons.
Lay it on me. What was their rationale?
They genuinely believed that more speech, even from corporations, is better than less speech.
Because it leads to a more informed public.
Exactly. They argued that trying to regulate speech, even if it's well-intentioned, can lead to censorship.
So their thinking was, let everyone have their say, even if we don't like what they're saying.
It's that classic marketplace of ideas argument that the truth will eventually emerge if we allow for a free and open exchange of viewpoints.
It's a noble sentiment, but it's hard to ignore the potential downsides.
The potential for money to distort things, for corporate interests to drown out the voices of the people.
It's a tension, right? We want to uphold free speech, but we also want to make sure the system is fair.
That's the challenge. And Bilotti, it really brings that challenge to the forefront.
It's like this Pandora's box of issues. Corporate power, free speech, campaign finance, the role of money in politics.
And once you open that box, it's hard to close it.
This deep dive into Bilotti is making my head spin, but in a good way.
It's a case that keeps on giving, right? It's got so many layers, so many implications.
It makes you think about the big questions, the really fundamental questions about how our democracy works.
And whether it's working the way it should.
Okay, so we've talked about the majority opinion, the dissent, but there's one more piece to the puzzle.
Oh, right. Chief Justice Berger. He had a concurring opinion.
Concurring meaning he agreed with the outcome, but maybe not the reasoning.
Exactly. And his take on Bilotti, it adds a whole other wrinkle to this already complex case.
Okay, I'm hooked. Tell me more.
He basically threw a wrench into things by highlighting the unique role of media corporations.
Interesting. So he was saying that news outlets, because of their role in informing the public, maybe they deserve special consideration.
That seems to be his point. He seemed to recognize that a free press, it's vital for a healthy democracy.
But he also acknowledged that media corporations, they can have a lot of power.
Right.
They can shape public opinion in profound ways.
Exactly. And that raises questions about media ethics, about the responsibility of journalists to report fairly and accurately.
And about whether corporate ownership of media outlets, if that influences what gets reported and how.
It's a whole other can of worms.
My brain is exploding. We've got corporate free speech, individual rights, the power of money in politics, and now we're adding media ethics to the mix.
Bilotti, it's like this ever-expanding universe of complex and interconnected issues.
It really is.
Yeah.
It makes you realize that all these things, they're not just abstract legal concepts. They're the stuff that shapes our everyday lives.
They determine how our society functions, who has power, who gets heard.
Well, this deep dive into Bilotti has been anything but simple.
It's a case that keeps on giving.
It's forced us to confront some uncomfortable truths about the role of corporations in our society.
And about the challenges of upholding free speech in a world where money often talks louder than anything else.
Before we wrap things up, I have to ask, where do we go from here? What are the lessons we can take away from Bilotti and apply to the world today?
I think the biggest takeaway is that this debate, the debate about corporate power and its place in our democracy, it's not over.
It's an ongoing struggle.
Exactly. Bilotti was a pivotal moment, but it was just one chapter in a much longer story.
So what can we do? How can we make sure that our voices are heard amidst all the noise, all the corporate influence?
We have to stay informed. We have to engage in these conversations, even when they're uncomfortable.
We can't just sit back and let corporations dictate the terms of the debate.
We have to demand a system that truly reflects the values of fairness, equality, and the power of the people.
Well said. This deep dive into First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti has been a wild ride.
It has. Full of twists and turns.
And it's definitely left me with more questions than answers, but I think that's a good thing.
It is. It means we're thinking critically, that we're not just accepting the status quo.
And that's the first step towards creating a better, more just society.
Couldn't agree more. Understanding cases like Bilotti is crucial.
It helps us see the bigger picture, the historical context, the forces at play.
And that knowledge, it's empowering. It gives us the tools to participate in shaping the future.
Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
A huge thank you to our expert for joining us and sharing your incredible insights.
Thanks for having me.
And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Keep those conversations going. And until next time, keep exploring and keep questioning.
It really is. And, you know, Bilotti might seem like ancient history, but it's super relevant when we consider its connection to another landmark case.
What thing is Citizens United?
Bingo. Citizens United v. FEC. Decided in 2010.
That's the one that basically blew the lid off corporate spending in elections, right?
Exactly. Citizens United took the principles from Bilotti and really ran with them.
So how does Bilotti, a case about taxes in Massachusetts, connect to this whole Citizens United saga?
Well, think of Bilotti like laying the groundwork. It established that, yes, corporations have First Amendment rights, including the right to engage in political speech.
So it set the precedent.
It did. Right. And Citizens United built on that foundation and took it a step further by saying corporations and unions have the same rights as individuals when it comes to spending money in elections. Meaning they can spend as much as they want to support or oppose candidates, even if that spending is meant to influence voters.
So if Bilotti was like dipping a toe in the water, Citizens United was a cannonball.
A pretty big splash, yeah. And it really ignited the debate about money in politics.
Because critics argued that it gave corporations and wealthy special interests way too much power.
Right. It basically allowed them to buy influence, to drown out the voices of everyday citizens.
So all those fears that the dissenting justices in Bilotti had about corporate influence distorting the democratic process.
Those fears became reality.
It's like they saw the future.
They kind of did. And Citizens United amplified those concerns big time because suddenly corporations could pour unlimited money into super PACs and other political organizations.
So they could essentially bankroll candidates who supported their interests.
And that raises a lot of questions about whose interests are really being served.
Right. It makes you wonder if politicians are more beholden to their corporate donors than to the people they represent.
It's a valid concern. And it goes to the heart of what kind of democracy we want to have.
One where everyone has an equal voice, or one where the loudest voice, the one with the most money, wins out?
It's a fundamental question, and Bilotti and Citizens United force us to confront it.
So here we are, decades after Bilotti, and we're still grappling with this tension, right?
We are. This whole idea of corporate personhood, the role of money in politics, the balance between free speech and fair elections.
These are big issues.
They are, and they're playing out all around us. Every time we see a political ad funded by a corporation, every time we hear about corporate lobbying efforts.
Bilotti might be a case from the past, but its legacy is very much alive.
It's woven into the fabric of our political system.
This has been eye-opening, to say the least. It's amazing how a single case from the 1970s can have such a lasting impact.
It shows how deeply these issues are intertwined: free speech, corporate power, the very nature of democracy.
It's a lot to think about.
It is, but that's a good thing. We need to be thinking about these things. We need to be having these conversations.
Because the fight for a truly democratic society, it's an ongoing process.
It requires us to be informed, engaged, and to speak up.
We can't just be passive observers.
We have to participate. We have to demand a system that works for everyone, not just for those at the top.
Well said. This deep dive into First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti has been a wild ride.
It has, full of twists and turns.
But ultimately, I think it's left us with a better understanding of the challenges we face.
And the stakes involved.
It's a reminder that the fight for a more just and equitable society, it's a fight worth having.
Couldn't agree more. And understanding cases like Bilotti, it's a crucial part of that fight.
It gives us context. It helps us see the bigger picture.
And it reminds us that the future, it's not predetermined. We have the power to shape it.
So true. Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive into First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti.
It's been a pleasure.
A huge thank you to our expert for joining us and for sharing your insights.
Thanks for having me.
And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Keep those conversations going, keep exploring, keep questioning, and until next time, keep fighting the good fight.